I am also the parent of a four-year-old, and the reason I've undertaken this topic is because I realized that the arrival of my daughter in my life was as profound a theological experience and shift in the way I looked at things as anything that had happened before. And those of you who have some familiarity with the teaching of the Western tradition, by and large, Western Christian tradition, as well as Eastern, but we're more familiar with Western, has been formed and in the hands of persons who weren't doing the labor of parents. And so as important as the church has always held that work to be, I don't think it's been seen as a distinct theological resource. And my experience, and now that I have ears to hear it from those who are doing the same work, is that it is a very significant piece of our recognition of how God works in our lives and how we are called to do God's work on earth. So that's kind of what got me started. So it's a little mixture of theology. And when I use parenting materials, I want to make it clear I never teach those classes. I desperately attend them. And that one of the things, though, that was really very exciting for me is, in a way, what I realized is like the locker room at the Y, the group in my parenting class became my new sort of theological community for discussion. I mean, that it was just a very different kind of conversation there. And also an ecumenical one. People of all faiths have children. And so that it's been an immense resource in that way. So we've gone through a number of topics. Many of you have been here through the week, and for those of you who joined us, it's great to have you here. We're down to the last one, letting go. And I think one of the problems of having somebody at my stage of parenthood teaching it is that rather than being a difficulty, it's a cherished dream. Because in a four-year-old, you know, all the letting go sort of comes around, could you let go of my clothes? Could you let go of my knees? Could you, honey, I can, you know, and that if you're out of their sight, you know how it is, you finally think you'll get a shower, and especially if you're in a chalet with nine people, this is a difficult thing, and all of a sudden you hear, she's awake, and you didn't tell me you were leaving, you know, sort of. So that these are very different stage. Yes. And it's like saying, well, the whole village has heard you, and the whole village will take care of you until I'm dressed. But this is the sort of dilemma. But as I said to you the other day, my friend Deanne Lagerquist commented that when her son was born, one of the things her mother, and now here's probably a good key of parenting, talk about minimalist advice. Her mother's comment was, parenting is really all about letting go. And it starts from the minute they're born. And I've really pondered that one a lot, as I'm sure you yourselves do. Sometimes you, these little ages, you wake up in the morning and there is this person next to you, and you think, this person, I'm her mom, or I'm her dad. This primary identifier for them, and you sort of quake practically thinking, I'm not fit to be anybody's parent. And there's another way in which they're as familiar as any person will ever be to you, and moments when they're totally foreign. And you have that sense, and I'm sure you've also found that, haven't you, with little children, that sometimes a picture will be taken or a moment, and it's almost like you see in them the adult they're going to be. I mean, it's sort of eerie. I mean, that you're already, I mean, that they're moving beyond you. And how hard that is. We drive them crazy. And those of you who have children in adolescence, and adolescence, I think, in American society probably extends to age 30. In many ways, I mean, I don't mean that to sound kind of smarmy, but I mean, in many ways, I think that's often true. Clearly in certain socioeconomic brackets, but it becomes harder and harder, and that letting go, generally they see us as just repressive and unhelpful and not able to understand at all, and I think one of the things they have no sense for at all is the anguish it causes us. And so it's a funny thing. There's this very intimate, significant thing you have to do together, but you all of a sudden you feel pretty alone in it, you know, in a way, because they aren't going to be able to carry the same weight, some ways, through those years that you have to in making it happen. So what I'd like to do is, today I'm going to throw out some techniques, not mine, but some of the ones that in literature I've encountered for you to test, to think about, but also then talk about what I think this issue of letting go can maybe say to us about particularly how we think about God as parent. My premises are that this whole piece of letting go it's about communication, it's about sharing of power. Suddenly you're connected, and there has to be this question about who makes decisions, what decisions get made, how we look that's shifting as our children grow older, and that it starts early, long before adolescence. I often think that some of the problems that many of us encounter, we talked yesterday a little bit about the styles of parenting, that we came out of one that was more authoritarian. And I can actually remember this sort of sinking feeling in my stomach when I was in seventh grade. It was the first time I went to a school out of my neighborhood where I couldn't walk, I couldn't go home for lunch, to take a bus, I got to this big place. And it's so funny, I remember sitting there in a class that was not terribly interesting and looking around and realizing that in the row I was the only girl who had hairy legs. And thinking, ooh, I've missed something. Now, how do I make a decision like that? Am I supposed to do something about this, or is it okay? If I continue to wear white socks, is it okay? Or am I supposed to start wearing stockings? And I thought, but they were significant decisions at the time, and thinking, I have no frame of reference. And I'm actually kind of embarrassed that I don't know. And thinking, here's a piece that some really sort of critical decision, they were just made for me in my family when I was little. And I don't mean that blaming, it was good. But what happened was then all of a sudden there was a space where they couldn't make them, or they weren't there, you know. And I felt really sort of ill-prepared to make the decisions and to weigh how I might make them, how I could even talk about them, because I was sort of embarrassed that I seemed kind of like a dork, you know, in this. So I think one of the arguments is that what we have to start with this process with children is very, very early. That as much as we think they can't do anything, they start sort of early on, where at least some options can be presented. All right? Yeah, I mean, like our favorite is, I'm not going to take a bath. You know, anyway. And then I just say, well, you could take your bath before we go to Vespers, or you can take it tomorrow morning. Right? But you have some power about that without even engaging the question of the bath, you know, no bath, or, you know, or my bath, my turn, sort of. And I've been surprised. It's time consuming, but the points they're making is that this process for children of looking at options and see what you're doing as an adult early on is sort of offering these are valid options, helping them sort of set parameters and then choose among them in a way prepares them for making the decisions that are very hard, right? And for having some confidence in their ability to do it, and may I add, for using you as a resource instead of as the court of appeal. You know what I mean? We talked a little bit yesterday about what you don't want to do is always have to play judge and referee. And what's funny is they hate it when you do, but you see, in another way, they're the very ones that will spin out the scenario so that you have to, right? Because that's... So part of it is being sort of foxy here all the time. Like good preachers of the gospel, it's been pointed out that most of the time, what people will do when you offer them good news and in the empowerment and freedom of the Spirit is to say, well, that's all well and good, but in my case, how it doesn't apply. And I was told when I was in seminary that some of being a good preacher was like being a good fencing master. That every time they came at you with a but, you could counter it. There's a way which, as a parent, that some of what you will have to do, they will want to put you in the very role that they really will say, I don't want you there, and you don't want to get there. You know what I mean? And that the other thing is, if you start them with this decision stuff early, they do it all along, so you'll get real good at it too, so that by the time they're 13 and 14, you know, this won't be coming from left field. You'll have a sense of how they play out the scenario. So some of the techniques, these are two. This book, I think, is in the bookstore here. If you don't have this book, get this book. Because even if you don't have children at home, you have adults. You have children hiding in adult bodies in your life. Shall we put it that way? And that you will be very surprised at some really just solid stuff here about communication techniques. But particularly, and what's really nice is they play out scenarios. It's a fun read, so I recommend that one. Then another thing, this is a program that I took because it's the hour the class was offered I could get in. But Systematic Training for Effective Parenting, and I have found parts of this to be very helpful, and it's very elemental. Small sections to read. Parents do not generally have time for 60 and 70 page disquisitions, you know, that and some good elements of things to think about. So that's what I'm drawing off here. I want to start. This is a section on communicating with children, and I found this one really helpful. Here are the roles that you are likely to play. These are some options, or get cast in because it's familiar. So think of yourself, commander-in-chief. The parent who plays this role is interested in keeping things well under control and demands that the child get rid of the negative feelings immediately and shape up. The moralist. The moralist is a shouldist. You should do this, you shouldn't do that, is what this parent preaches. The know-it-all. Parents who play this role try to show the child that adults have been traveling life's road for a long time and have accumulated most of its answers. These parents lecture, advise, make appeals to the child's reason, and try to show how superior they themselves are. The judge. This parent has already pronounced the child guilty without a trial. Judges are always interested in proving that they are right. The critic. Like the judge, the moralist, and the know-it-all. The seven faces of Eve. That's sometimes I look at this and think, I can do all these at once. If you really get it to me. Just move right along. The know-it-all parent playing this role is interested in being right. But the critic relies on ridicule, name-calling, sarcasm, or jokes that the child experiences as put-downs. The psychologist. The psychologist tries to analyze the problem. With the best intentions, this parent wants to hear all the details so that the parent will be in a better position to set the child straight. They tend to offer diagnosis and analysis. The consoler. Parents who play this role attempt to excuse themselves from involvement by treating the child's feelings lightly. Simple reassurance or a pat on the back. Oh, it'll be okay. And the pretense that all is well when it isn't are this parent's answer to worry and anxiety. Now, what I like about this, after laid out, he said, while we are strong in our criticisms of these roles, we wish to emphasize that the parents who play them do not do so maliciously, but with the best of intentions. And I think that's the piece of always letting yourself off the hook. Frankly, a child in distress is a terrifying experience for us. And what we do in some ways is try to get control of it, and those are very sort of natural roles. And the other thing they'll argue is sometimes they're appropriate. I mean, sometimes you can step in one or the other of those ways. But as a rule, you have to be very careful. And so I found that helpful sometimes in, you know, thinking about what would my response be to this. Or if this happens, or when I see it happen with another child, in the heat of the moment, sometimes it's difficult. But you can begin to catch yourself. And you know, as difficult as this may be, this is the kind of thing, I think, with a child who's a little older, that you can discuss with them so that they can say, that's what I see you doing right now. I mean, remember, if this is a communication, you may think you're being bad, but there, the result of it will tell you as much as anything to hear from them. So, one of the things in those kinds of roles is looking at children's behavior and what we see as misbehavior. Children are very smart. I think most psychologists are arguing that behaviors are goal-directed. They have a social purpose. It's just that the children are not always going to be conscious of what they're trying to do. And this STEP program draws off of this idea that you can look at misbehavior. One of the first questions you need to ask yourself is, what is its goal? And in this funny sense, actually, as a parent, you will know more often than the child will. And that's exactly where your role comes in of, who is the adult here? But what I thought was interesting is their argument is you come to some of those conclusions by the consequence it has for you, by its effect in you. And there was this wonderful father in our group who looked up and he said, well, that's good. He said, although it seems to me it's based on the assumption that I got my psychological shit together. I remember quite well sort of looking at it and said, well, the parent person, the coordinator argued that actually if he started doing this, it might help him deal with the compost. And but what I think this is interesting in looking at behavior, that children will do things, I mean, that they sort of give these levels to get attention, about power. The next step would be about revenge. And finally, what can become just a sort of really dispirited display of inadequacy. I don't want to go into that, but I think if you get a whole book like this, this was very revealing to me, particularly this bit about these fights over power, that if a child is trying to get attention, you will experience them as annoying. And you do often sense the line when you cross from being annoyed to the point where you really begin to feel angry. Right? That what a child is trying to do is dominate, and this is the place, they say, where anger becomes, I think this is the part we're most scared of in our parenting. And with adolescents, you know these blow-ups around anger are breathtaking. The slamming doors, the nasty language sometimes. And what they, let me describe this to me. It says, power-seeking children feel they are significant only when they are boss. They seek to do only what they want. And it's sort of their refrain, no one can force me to do anything, or you better do what I want. Even if parents do succeed in subduing them, the victory is only temporary. Parents may win the argument, but in some ways lose the battle because the child has succeeded in setting anger, power plays, as sort of the baseline for how they relate. When a child is defiant, parents feel angry and provoked. Attempts to correct the child are seldom successful. The child will defy the parents and continue the unacceptable behavior, or will stop temporarily, and this is where you get sort of thing, and then continue with greater intensity. Some children in power struggles do what they are told, but not in a way the parents want it done. This we call defiant compliance. As a rule, when dealing with power-seeking children, this is it, adults must refrain from getting angry and disengage themselves from the power struggle, because if you use power attack, in other words, if you try to let your anger overpower their anger, what you have succeeded in doing is maybe shutting them up for a while, but you've only impressed them with the value of power and increased their desire for it. See, it is being there. It's sort of like, I thought that was the best thing to have, and I'm right. Right? That's what if the struggle for power continues and the children come to feel they cannot defeat the parents, and notice the elevation of the language there, they may alter the desire for power and pursue the third goal, which is revenge. Children who pursue revenge are convinced that they are not lovable. Parents of the revengeful child feel deeply hurt and want to retaliate. Can you see? I mean, it's just it's a perfect picture of escalation. So, to me, this was very, and then in the end, you see, if revenge doesn't work, what they think, they finally get, I mean, a totally dispirited child, in some ways, who feels, I just can't do anything. I can't win that battle. I can't do anything. And the irony of it is that a child who is greatly pampered and spoiled may manifest that just as readily as a child who's abused. Because what they keep hearing is, I'm not able to deal with things. Right? They don't have enough confidence in me. They got to take care of everything for me. But if the battle gets pitted for power, in terms of anger, it's very likely it will rise to revenge. And I mean, I spoke the other day about a therapist friend of mine who said that oftentimes she thinks parents live in a state of siege that is quite akin to what it's like to be in an abusive relationship, where they're walking on eggshells, wondering what's going to trigger the next thing, where they're really terrified of the anger. They may sometimes be cowed by it. They may try to feel that what they have to do is dampen it down, and that requires overpowering it. But in the end, the one thing that can't exist in a family like that is honest feeling and truth speaking. So to say, I mean, and I've heard parents say that. This is not to blame. You're right. It's hell. And it's not hell. And the sort of, well, I think maybe it's a similar news. Actually, very often if you're in a household with an adult where that kind of thing is going on, if you think that person can be appealed to make it different, you're wrong. Because that's precisely the problem. Like this description of these children, sort of in a sea of trying to have power, finding a place where they belong, feeling like they're somebody, it's pitted against this other. That if it's to change, that's one of the key roles of being a parent. You have to be the adult to make it change. And I know a series of books. There's a little quote that I found helpful. A child does not misbehave unless he or she feels a real or threatened loss of status. And remember that precisely when they're in this period of transition, like adolescence, the place where they belong and who they are is exactly the thing that's in flux. So having status is a lot harder. And it begins to make sense. You know, you read those articles about these kids that shoot somebody dead because they stole a pair of sneakers, or that they have to have, you know, a jacket that costs over $100 that they're not even going to be able to wear by the time they graduate from high school, should they live so long. And you begin to understand how this battle is getting pitched, right, about status. So it's out of all proportion to what's going on. So, Harry, yes, please.
That loss of status, I think, gets back to how you started the decision-making. The loss of status is already there by the time most kids are teenagers. Right. And it isn't that it starts developing during those difficult years.
No, yeah, that's right. It is already there. And in some ways, if you haven't started laying some of those patterns down so they have something to fall back on, about how they can make decisions, how they can think through difficult things, that's a very hard time to begin it. And it's a good point.
But there are a lot of kids and parents who are do begin it right then, and that's where the real learning has to take place.
Yes, as one of the parent educators I have taken classes with said, you know, you don't want the first significant decision-making your children do to be whether they're going to take drugs when it's offered to them in the hallway, or whether they're going to drive home from a dance with a kid who's drunk. Right? You'd rather they made some significant decisions about just how many chocolate bars do you eat before your stomach feels terrible, and why you might not want to pump, you know, you want it to, so that they have practice, and they have some values around themselves about the choices that they make. And a good point. Well, there's a psychologist named Harriet Golder Lerner who's written a whole series of books about, they all have the dance in the title, The Dance of Anger, The Dance of Intimacy, The Dance of Deception, in one of the others. But one of her arguments is that, again, much like we've talked about our relationship to God, it's not that something's got to get fixed in God or something's got to get fixed sort of in us for it to work, but the pattern of how we dance with one another is not right. And in some sense, what justification does is shift some important piece, so precisely God's ability to fence off all our but, you can't put me back in that role. I've taken this role as Savior, and that's the way you'll get me. So now that you know that, how are you going to respond? Right? That there's a way, with as a parent, what they're arguing is here, you have to take that role bit to change the dance. All right, when you see it sort of coming around this, not that there's no place for anger. I mean, a lot of it is recognizing a right use of anger. I mean, I think it's part of our theological tradition, too, that it's to our advantage that we have a God who can be angry. But when anger works to clear the air, to be a truthful expression, and when it becomes, as it does here, sort of just the battleground. So what is it? Now think of the number of times, and your kids push, and they push, and they push, and finally you just blow up. And you win. When they're younger, because they're little, sometimes because they're afraid. But what it is, it's a little bit like saying, now, here I've approached this obstacle, and what I've done is overpower it. But frankly, they've won, because they've got you just where they want you. Right? I mean, that if they're pushing for revenge or whatever, it's only confirming what they, you know, what they thought. Power's the important piece. So what this is about is bringing it to a point where you can't overpower me anymore. So that as hard as it is, it's to begin this change of sort of disengaging, or even these habits of how you respond in communication. And they'll tell you the first time you do it, they'll be like, and as we all know, in any system, in dance, I keep thinking of aerobics class, if somebody doesn't follow the program, somebody else gets stepped on. That there's a lot of pressure to get everybody back into the pattern, even if it's not a healthy one. That your children, surprisingly enough, won't like it when you start becoming a more understanding and responsible parent in some ways at first, because it's unfamiliar. But that's that role in a way of letting go. And one of the first things, it's sort of, you know, standing out of that. Now, sometimes that anger expresses itself, I think, in such physical extremity, you need really to protect them from themselves. But having done that, I mean, a refusal to engage on inflamed territory. You know, to say there's something here that needs to be talked about, it ain't going to be talked about now. This is not a time for talking. Right? That can be very disconcerting, but I think, you know, sets this one of those first things, so be wary of the anger, because it is natural to feel it. And I don't want to say that you should never get angry. What I say is that may be exactly the time you need to go to the gym and do your aerobics upstream or something. You need to do it, but don't let it become the ground on which you meet the child. Because in a funny way, it's not letting go at all. It's becoming unbelievably enmeshed. Hey. I mean, it is. It is, I mean, those of you who've ever been in a relationship that's sort of spiraling down to its terminus, you will notice that oftentimes when you can't meet on any other ground, the least they can do is provoke you to be angry with them, right? And it's a sign right there. You're still engaged enough to get mad. So, that having said that, then looking at some of these pieces, I've talked about recognizing what role are you trying to play when they come to you. That one of the important things about encouraging communication is what distinction they've made between closed and open responses. You know, the kind of response that invites or at least allows for a child to, and this would be good not just for children, but to elaborate rather than sort of setting it off. Just, that's the end of it. Part of this is reflective listening. Now, we all know that this is, if you say, it sounds like you're very, you know, here's your kid pummeling your stomach. It says, it seems, you seem to be very angry with me. And you feel like, no, nobody noticed. But I think we have to remember is that in a way that is an acknowledgement, it's reflecting back, it's giving and giving them a language for things they may not quite have the language for yet. And I think that happens again in adults. And sometimes can help them move beyond and say, I'm angry. It's not really about you, but you're here. Right? Now, as it's been pointed out, you have to use this with discretion. If you do that all the time, it can become quite onerous for a child who would like at some point just to say something and get on with his life instead of having this, gee, I think I hear you saying. In fact, one of our great lessons for this to me, we had a student who took clinical pastoral education and had not, obviously, so he'd learned these great skills and he went to see this crusty old fellow in the hospital who just complained about everything. You know, he was ready to go home and this guy goes, well, I hear you saying, finally the guy apparently just stopped in his dream and looked at him and said, what the hell's the matter with you? You some kind of parrot? I prepared to attend to that. I mean, that there may come a point where, and it's like picking all your battles wisely. Every time a kid grumps through the room like this, it's not to say, gee, you look like something's bothering you. Would you like to talk? You know, you don't have to do that every time. But pick some of them and recognize that, what is it, to give them a name for it and to invite that into conversation. And I think another really important one, a concept of problem ownership, maybe some of you have heard of, is that anything that happens in our family circles tends to engulf all of us. I mean, a child who's off in the ozone makes life miserable for the siblings, and so that we sort of move into this, we've got to fix it, got to fix it, got to fix it. That in a quiet moment, sit there and think, now what is the problem here, and whose is it really? Right? If your child is having a hideous bad hair day and weeping in front of the mirror, is it really your responsibility to fix that? And you say, well, that's a problem. You have to try to resolve that. If their behavior or whatever the problem is isn't really impinging on you, you may not be crazy about it, but it's not really impinging on you. Wait until you can just let it go. This is back to what I said yesterday about boundaries. When they're actually quite happy with what's going on and their needs are being satisfied, but it is causing problems for you, then you do have a problem. They don't, but you do. And then it's being able to talk, well, what is it that isn't working here for me? And to talk to them about it. And then the simple one of being able to use I messages. I mean, it's the kind of thing, you know, like Lucy, and I think this is true with younger children especially. I think I know when I got older I did things that could be annoying because I figured sooner or later my mother would have to respond. But when they're little, actually, they just do what kids do, and they are kind of wonderfully centered in themselves, and they don't even think that this is driving you crazy. So that you get to the point where you go, hey, will you take that out of here? I'm trying to read. I can't read when you do that sort of. And they'll look at you like, well, I didn't know you had a problem. So, I mean, you know, that, and I think that is the point about being able to say, describing the situation in terms of when you turn the light on and off and on and off and on and off. I find myself, you know, state your feeling about it. I get really frustrated because I need to read this for work. Right? That's a very different way of saying that to her than waiting until. And I remember one time when she did that, and she, it was like, it, she, well, I thought, well, why would she have a clue? She can't read. Right? I mean, that's not turning lights on and off. So, I mean, that's sort of a basic one, but we're saying if you can start young with that kind of thing, then it can come to the ones like, you know, when you go out with that group of people, I worry because I'm not sure you're going to be come home safely. When you, when you leave the house and don't tell me where you're going, I'm frightened because I don't know what's happened to you. When you call me ugly names like that, I'm hurt because I don't find myself in those names. I mean, and it really can move to those people, so that in a way, I want to say in a way, I think one of the powers of that is this thing about being turned in on yourself. That's in many ways what they are, and you've got to kind of move in the orbit. But when you do that, you confront them with another. I'm not just your mom or your dad. I'm a feeling person who cares about you, who can be hurt, and who recognizes you enough as when I admit that to you, you have that power over me. And now I'm calling you to account to use it well, to think about using it responsibly. It is at first very disconcerting, and I want you to be careful. I mean, I had one of my good friends in seminary said, my gosh, every time my mother's just off in her room sobbing, oh, you kids, I don't know what, you know. She said it was great blackmail. She said, oh, you know, and I don't mean that. You know, it can be that kind of emotion. How could you do this to your mother? through all I've been through for you. Sort of. Not that at all, but this is a very, I think, sort of honest expression of the effects of this. And that however we make our decisions, we have to take into consideration the effects around the room. When you do that, when you blow up like that and scream and yell at me, I get really upset because it frightens your sister. She's frightened in her home of what will happen. And even to the point of saying, when you do that, I'm frightened because I think you might hit me. You know, I mean, that as I'm saying, if you look at the way that could move forward, it's not to say my problem is your problem and you have to fix it for me, but to say there's a bigger arena here. And what I'm asking you to think about as you make your choices about your behavior.
That assumes that children are rational human beings, especially little children. And they're not.
Do you think they're wholly on?
I mean, I agree. You know, I tend to agree with Margaret Mead is that the whole approach that we make as American parents is that if parents are, or if children are bad, it's the parents' fault.
Yeah.
And so we always run around with a lot of guilt, whereas the British always view children as evil little monsters that parents civilize at great cost.
By sending to boarding school, usually.
Well, in some cases it works.
Would you say it's worked with the royal family?
I do think what you're talking about is about what the impact in trying to reason this behavior out. What this does is that it uses guilt as a motivator. Rather than simply a looking in the eye and say that this behavior is not acceptable, and you know that, and you wouldn't want it done to you, what children I believe need more than anything else is safety and security, and one of mm-hmm. the most frightening things to a child is their own behavior,
mm-hmm.
because they realize sometimes that they're. What they're capable of at a very early age, you know, of what they're able to do with in hurting someone, maybe sometimes even their own parent. I remember one of the most frightening things in my life was when I was playing around and I, you know, some kind of horse play or something with my mother, and you know, I got hit her in the eye with an elbow. I really hurt her, and it was not intentional.
Yes.
It was playing.
Yeah.
It was an awful feeling because mother was now vulnerable to me. And that's not something that my mother ever wanted to communicate to me, that I was not safe, you know, in her presence.
Well, you know, Jim, I think in one way you're right about the reasoning. I mean, I think that, but the other side of it is when you say this behavior is unacceptable and you know that. I think, I mean, there comes a certain point we have to develop that they know that.
Exactly.
They don't know that.
If your child is pummeling you, That's just not acceptable. However it is that you stop that behavior, mm-hmm. whatever it takes to stop the behavior, you stop it. Otherwise, I believe what happens is that children will grow up thinking that everybody in the world whom they pummel is going to treat them like their mother did. Try to, you know, to let them go ahead and pummel them until they got it out of their system. Well, that's nonsense.
No, and I think, I mean, those are extremes. I think safety and security for everybody sort of has to be a bottom line. But I think like the ones about breaking curfews or, you know, refusing to come to dinner or that you're supposed to take care, pick up your little brother at softball and you blow it off.
Right.
You know, that there are ways that one wants to talk about that to understand why that would be unacceptable.
One of the things that you do with your kids as far as letting, you know, when they go off and they don't tell you where they're going, is that you always let them know where you are.
Yeah.
You know, I call you and I let you know where I'm going to be and when I'm going to come home. Mm-hmm. If I'm not going to make it at that time, I call you.
But I think there that issue of reciprocity, I think, is a very important one. But I still think, I mean, to say, and this is why I do it, right? Why you can't expect that of me, why I would expect that of you. I think we don't want to, it's part of it, isn't it? It's sort of wanting our children to develop a kind of an internal monitor so that there are certain extremes that we think they will just recognize are out of line. But we can look around in our society and see that that apparently is not so self-evident to many of them. But even if you say, you know, you can't, a bottom line in this family is, these are the house rules. We don't hurt each other physically, okay? We are responsible for our health. You are expected to take care of yourself in certain ways, you know, or whatever. But then there's all this sort of gray area oftentimes, and how they might think those things through. Why would I do this or not do that? What might its consequences be? Not just for me, but for other people, that I'm with you, I'm a little care about too much. I mean, looking at Lucy sometimes and saying, when you do that, when you do that, it really makes me angry and I don't want to be with you. And that does it. I mean, she gets that. But what I'm saying is, when behavior needs a response, in some ways, I think oftentimes for children to begin to make those discernments in the middle range, when they're looking at choices and weighing consequences of how it's going to affect things, that's where I think this can be helpful, that parents are some of the first ones to verbalize it so they'd even know what to look for in other partners they engage with who, unlike their parents, don't have to be so intimate with them, you know, like you say, to say, hurting me is out. I'm your mother, you know. Yeah, back here, please, and then up here.
I think one of the things, Jan, that if you're talking these kind of classes, one of the things we talk about is this kind of obnoxious behavior stuff. And what we forget is that there's a whole groundwork that's laid to play this out on. It's a groundwork of simply loving our children and being present for them. And in my work, I encounter lots of kids when they're 10, 12, 13 years old who really do are vicious, terrible, scary kids who hurt people violently. And those kind of kids, because they have learned power, all they get in their lives is power, and trying to defeat it. Or rich kids who are spoiled rotten, spoiled being given stuff instead of their parents' hearts. But for the most part, as we give our children our hearts and love them, when these other things come up, we can deal with them. Sometimes, you know, I had my time being too hard, but that was put on a background. So I also was able to also monitor myself as well as watching her response. Mm-hmm. Because that's why I learned the hard stuff. That's what my dad taught me. But I was in a position to monitor it because she was also getting my heart. And her mom's heart, too.
Yeah.
And our hearts. So I think that's as we look at these things, we need to be careful that it's being played on, where it's being played out on.
Yes, that's right. And that really has been our subject beginning earlier in the week to say, yes, that's right. I mean, none of this will work. First of all, nobody's going to put this kind of energy in with a human being they don't love. I mean, that's what this is, very labor intensive.
Some parents don't love their kids, but
yeah,
that's still not the normal thing.
No. And I think what we can look at is some of these ways of thinking. How might we show that love? And help them make some of these moves. I mean, so that love, at the same time that it holds them close, also begins to help put down sort of stepping stones by which they can move away, because that's one of the things they really have to do, and at some point make some of these very hard choices without us being there anymore, you know. And I guess, Jim, part of what?
But not at 4 years old.
Oh, well, I'm not talking, but we're talking about adolescence. Okay. Adolescence. But I think four-year-olds can make more choices than you realize.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, if...
You want
if,
chocolate or vanilla?
Well,
yeah.
I mean, if they, yeah, yeah, and if they're given the space, and I will say, I am very struck at how early on, whether we want to look at it as guilt, is the tenderness of their hearts to weigh their behavior by its effects on others. Yeah, and I know we could say that's just guilt, or we could also say it's the very thing that Christ is trying. You know, what does he say? Your hardness of heart, that you cannot feel what it's like to be in this other place, that you cannot care, so that when you say, look, this is why we don't do this, well, you just whack the baby with a mug, you know. Does it look like the baby liked that? You know, do you understand how in your interactions with your children that somebody is scared or somebody is uncomfortable? I remember being so touched one time when I went to pick up my daughter at daycare and the teacher pulled me aside and said, I'd like to get something for Lucy. And I just wanted to check with you if it was all right. And I thought, please let it not be a straitjacket. You know what? What do you want to get her, a cat of nine tails? But, you know, but what she said was that new girl had come into this school, had been there, and just didn't mix with anybody. Just sat by herself. And she said, Lucy went over there today. Stacy really didn't want to play, but she sat with her through this so she wouldn't be alone. And she said, I think that's such a lovely thing. I want to thank her for helping me do my work. Now, I mean, Lucy wasn't even four that could sense that. So that's what I'm saying, is that to be able, the way this woman could articulate, give Lucy a language also about the situation that she already had some heart smarts about. Right, and me having to fight the thing is, but you know, Lucy, you do not have to go sit with Stacy by the fence every day. Right, that's the other thing. That is now not your responsibility. And so that's what I'm saying, Jim. But I found that her routine. How did you feel about that? How do you feel about it now that you've had to do it for 5 days? Yeah. So like I said, there's a hand up here.
Yeah, I was just going to point out, when children grow up, some parenting tests are not completely done with some children. And then the parent feels guilt, you know. And the letting go on the parent's part involves letting society take over. Mm-hmm. Where you can't, you're aware that the behavior is still there. And you've done what you could. But you've done what you could is the key.
Yes.
You know, you have to come at it from a different
perspective. I think that's quite right. And I do think that one of the helpful things now, one of the things that people come at, but we don't cause our children to misbehave. I mean, that we can sort of let ourselves off that hook. But probably what our thing is, how we can respond. I mean, you say, if we're building on this basis of love, that you can recognize parents, and that way sort of counter them in ways, you see, that isn't going to reinforce. But what you're pointing out is quite right. You may do so much, and it's not going to make the problem better. It's not going to completely take care of it. But you've done what you could. And sort of recognizing it. And I think probably one of the hardest things for any of us is sometimes just to say, you know, my kid's really got a problem there. And how can I, and this is, I think, the safety and security issues that we come up against, is something that they don't begin to appreciate at the same level we do, of how much fear we have for them. Trying just to bring them through those years, and then also be willing to recognize our limits. Yes, please, here.
At what point do you turn to outside resource support?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, one of the things that's in this thing about talking so children will listen and listen so children will talk, that as they line up, how do you sort of foster independence in a child? And their assumption is, remember that dependence is an unstable position to be in. To be dependent is, in one way, to be safe, because somebody else is responsible for everything. In another way, to be quite nervous about whether they're going to deliver. And ultimately, it breeds resentment. So in a way, that's the trajectory you're moving towards when your children come to adolescence, right? That they're both trying to let go and not wanting to, and they're resenting the amount of power that you have over them. So as one looks at that, if they make choices, I think one of the pieces of advice I'd never thought of before is how all along you should encourage children to use resources outside the home. You know, that, I mean, and it's simple things. I mean, when we got, Lucy got a cat for her fourth birthday. And I remember I always took her with me to the vet, and she'd ask, I said, well, why don't you ask the vet about that instead of, you know, like I was the know-it-all. Can we do this? And what I'm saying is that many times it could diffuse part, our children come up about against rocky places that we may not be their best resource. And that they, if they're encouraged all along to think they can go outside the family circle for practical advice, like they get interested in rocks and you don't know anything about them, you know, or that includes librarians. And then I think that piece about professional advice, so often this is felt as a shame. Personally, I think the good way to look at therapists, whatever, is much like how many people feel ashamed when they have a sore throat and they get some advice about how to work it. How do you feel ashamed when you consult somebody about how to make your will or invest your assets, you know, or that you have a job to do and you know some of it and not all of it, and that's exactly what those resources are for, and that in some cases it's maybe easier for the parties involved to talk. And I think if this advice given here about how you measure what's going on, you know, because am I annoyed, am I angry, or whatever, well, frankly, if you get to the point where you just feel you can't cope anymore, or you're at the end of your rope, that's an appropriate time to take the reading from you. And rather than have being embarrassed for the child, you could just say, well, I think maybe this is my problem. If I did this, whose problem is this anyway? This is my problem. But and there are many resources available. I think schools are a very good one. You good teachers, or maybe guidance counselors. These people must know a lot about your kids that you don't, because you don't see them there. So I guess I'd sort of take that internally, and I think I wouldn't wait until I were desperate. Do you know what I mean? That when you just start feeling really burdened, it's okay to ask for help.
You get into that power business. That there have to be some signals out there that we recognize. We know a yellow light when we see it on the corner.
Good point, yeah.
And that we ought to be able to have some signals that say, oh, wait a minute now, things may not be going the way you want them to.
I think a suggestion here would be to me one, at least not so far with my child, but in other family and personal relationships, to say this thing about anger is a good one. Mm-hmm. Is that watching how that enters into things, how quickly it comes, and is to say, wait a minute, we've moved on to ground that is shaky for building. And if you find yourself feeling angry a lot, I mean, there's a place where it's a very physical thing, and your body doesn't lie.
But there's such a thing as a passive parent, a passive child that drifts into society and follows the leaders.
Well, yes, I have a feeling there are, Remy, that
you like don't, to find one.
Well, listen, before we get all worried about this, let's stop and think. Lots of people come through this just fine. I don't want you to feel like I'm preparing you for a nuclear holocaust. I mean, you know, a lot of people come through this just fine. With sort of minimal trauma, but I don't think anybody goes through it without some ripples. Here, hand up here and then here.
Oh, I was just gonna say, I think what parents have a tendency to do is wait. So you think it's just a phase, and then they end up with a year that's been really lousy and you're in a real rotten place, and you can wait.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't even really have to be uncomfortable. I just find, if you're curious, you know, if you just like say, I'm not really, I found actually one of the best sources where I started was with Lucy's pediatrician. I just said, I've noticed this on all, you know, it's been a long time since I've been three, and I don't know what, and, you know, and that was kind of a beginning to think about it, that why would you know all that? I mean, why? You're right, that it's much harder to sort of change these patterns when you're under terrific stress because you feel like it's out of control than it is sort of to start gradually. Yes, please.
Be kind of went past the point I was going to add to what you were saying about about going to outside sources when they're young. Another problem, I think, in culture is that parents want to hold on when they're four and when they're five, when they're six. And so when they're 14 and 15 and they really need the outside source, and they will go to an outside source, it's a new experience, and they may choose the wrong outside sources. Right.
And it may feel like it's stigmatized instead of normal. Yeah. I think another piece is, and I go back to what Jim was saying about this sort of impossibility of being, but there has to be a place where we begin to talk and get them to talk. Because one of the things is, I don't know, I bet all of you feel the same way. I can't begin to imagine what the society and the world that my daughter will enter as an adolescent is going to be like. It's going to be so different from the one I knew that really does seem quite protected. And, you know, with, I mean, I think of little things like, even when I was in grade school, my parents were both working, and my dad actually got off a little earlier than my mother, so we got home from school a little bit after 3. My dad got home 15 to 20 minutes after I did, and my mother just let us go home. You couldn't do that. Now, I know we were bad, and we kept making witch's brew in the toilet. She took our key away and made us stay out in the yard right until Dad got home. And, I mean, it was a reasonable solution, right? I mean, we actually understood that it was better to be out of temptation's way. But you couldn't do that anymore. You couldn't just say a reasonable thing here until you can be more, are you ready to handle this? Clearly not, since both toilets are bright red. Is that you stay out in the yard until your dad gets home. Well, you couldn't do that now. And so one of the things that I want to say is I think a lot harder for you is building up independence and a certain sense of autonomy is a frightening business now in a way that I don't think it was when many of us grew up. Even in small towns, you don't. I mean, you just, and so I think how we can speak honestly to our children about the safety and security issues that we are the adults who have things over, but let's not assume we really know what's going on in their world. I think often that's the mistake. Why is it so important to you to have this pair of sneakers? Why is it so important to you to be able to go to the mall? What do these things mean in the world in which you, and that we have a great deal to learn. And that is probably the place, Jim. I mean, where it's a little hard to think your parents aren't all knowing. That they don't, but that's where it really does happen. Where suddenly you just have to say, we inhabit kind of different worlds. I'm not with you in the halls of your junior high school. I don't really know what you're trying to navigate. You have to help me understand. So that we make some decisions here, they may not be wholly satisfying to any of the parties involved, but they make sense. You see what I mean? And that we really have to make them together. Yes.
In all of this, is there a reference to Christianity and the Christian way of doing things, or not necessarily?
Well, I think there is for some people, and I think other peoples will invest it with different values. But I do think, not necessarily inimical values, but I mean values that are rooted in other religious traditions or ethical traditions. I think perhaps sometimes one of the problems is that people don't really have any clear sense of what their priority of values would be. So that, don't you think that as we look at our children and talk about how we want them in a sense to fit in, to find a place in a society where they are of service, right? Where they are able to, I mean, if status is this question, that one of the best ones is say, what will you do that will be of meaning and a value of compassion so that, you know, Lucy's understanding for this little girl at 3 could be a similar understanding when she's 33 about people who are homeless. That there's where I think, you know, that's how we wait. And in a way, compassion begins in this family circle. You have needs for autonomy. But let's talk about how within this family these decisions have impacts and think about what can we come to that's going to work for all of us. Now, I think that's it. There are times when they can be reasonable and times where they simply cannot in this surge. And so I'm not saying you're going to be able to do this all the time. But what it is, I mean, to keep coming at and inviting a child into that kind of conversation seems to me a very dramatic shift in the exercise of power. As it shared, and more a sense of how this child then might think through these things in places where you're not there. Or talk about them with others, do you see what I mean? And say, what are the things that are valuable when we decide that you be safe is important to me, that other people don't come to harm, right? What might be, and I think what this will lead you to do is you're going to have to be very clear about what's the bottom line of the values in your household that inform that kind of decision making. So I think what can happen there is then at the same time as you kind of let go, I mean, I think another important thing for children to see is how do you shape yourself in your autonomy, right? And I, one of the things that struck me, if I say to Lucy, as I would now, you know, mommy just doesn't have either the money or the energy or whatever to go to family swim at the Y today, or no, we're not going to get this, and let me, that I also find now, I think, you know, if I'm going to tell her how she's going to use some of her discretionary time, whatever, that she has a right to say the same to me. She can't always make the decisions for me, but early on now I find because she has to go with me in just about everything I do, that we talk a little bit about that. Right? If mommy accepts this speaking engagement, this is where we're going to be going, and how many times are we going to be able to do that? And clearly, as she gets older, that's going to have to weigh more and more. Right? That it's not just, I have the power to do whatever I want. And the other one, I think, is what are the things I do that are just for me? Because I think one of the hardest things we're going to find is that you have to fill some of those places in your life so that when it's time for children to go, they can go safely. And I mean this in terms of without guilt. That somehow or other, because they're smart enough to know, oh my gosh, if she doesn't have me to fight and cluck over, what's she going to do with the rest of her life, right? And I want to say, yes, that's exactly, and I weigh that because I'm a single parent with one child. The danger of the bond between us is already evident to me. And in this ironic way, for all that, this isn't the way it happens in my family. It has happened often enough for me to see it played out before. And that tells me volumes. You know, what I don't want to replicate. Okay. So I think there's that other piece of beginning to claim more and more, both parties, a place of one's own. Okay. Then one final piece I'll give you, and I just want to read a passage from Roberta Bondi. We often, be careful about what you think you have to control. One of the most helpful things I read in this is that, you know, kids' bodies are their own within the limits of safety. But maybe you don't like what they wear, but they can pick their own clothes. They can do what they want with their hair. It's very invasive. I mean, I even noticed that my daughter has her hair scarf, and I was brushing it this morning, and she finally turned around and said, I wish you would stop that. It's my hair, and it hurts. And I thought, it is her hair. And so people at Holden are going to think I'm a bad mother because she looks like Professor Irwin Corey all the time. You know? I mean, and that young, that it starts that young, you know. And I think it really starts around potty training. When I have to go, I'll be the first to tell you, Mom, right? Do we have to depart for every event with, don't you think you should use the potty before you go? And I think those are good. Part of it is when you feel out of control over some of the others, at least to turn them out looking nice can be a spurious sense of something is going well. But it isn't, and I think food is another one. Within this, I mean, it's one about you're responsible for your health and you need to take care, but you know, how much you're gonna, you protect it in some ways, but choose the battles wisely, I guess.
What about time lines? Pardon?
What about tongue rings?
Well, see, that would be a very hard one for me. But I think that falls in the area of safety, you know, in a way of being able to talk to a child. But this is something a little more than dyeing your hair purple or wearing a loincloth to confirmation. I'm sure the pastor will be able to deal with that.
That's when outside resources help.
That's when outside resources. I think it's time for you to go to Dayton's Oval Room for a fashion consult, honey. This is the case I mentioned of Roberta Bondi's that I think is a helpful one in us thinking about ourselves and what we're hoping for our children. If, as Calvin puts it, God moves from being judge to being father for us, there's another way in which we are to move from being dependent children to the children who can be friends. Perhaps the greatest reward we have as parents is when that moment comes, when suddenly, of course, our children know more than we do about some things because they inhabit territory that is not our own. But we meet in some ways as equals, as being, as knowing somehow that that natural sort of shift in the balance of power. It can be a long time coming, and it doesn't come with every child. But it does sometimes happen. This one, Roberta Bondi is talking about how she dealt with this image of the father, of God as father. And she wrote that her insight about this came like a blinding light, that the powerful Jesus, who is God, is not in fact the only major character in the story from John 11. She said, you recall the story. It begins in Bethany when Mary and Martha called Jesus to come heal their brother Lazarus, who is dying. With uncharacteristic insensitivity, Jesus does not go until Lazarus has actually died and been in the tomb for 4 days. When Jesus comes, Martha and Mary both confront him openly and even bitterly with their bewilderment and anger. Where were you when we needed you? They ask him. Do you not know that Lazarus' death was completely unnecessary? How could you have betrayed us like this? Jesus, on his part, does not threaten them for refusing to accept his will. Nor does he accuse them of lack of faith. He answers them seriously. Only then, weeping in frustration on the hold death still has on life, does Jesus raise Lazarus from the dead. This time, I heard the story in the context of my pondering on whoever has seen me has seen the Father. Now I recognize something else enormously significant I had believed about the meaning of God's fatherhood that I never before had known I believed. In my heart, I had been assuming that when Jesus told us to call God Father, he had meant that as God's children, we were to relate to that Father as very little children relate to that to the kind of benevolent, dominant parent who prefers toddlers to adolescents because toddlers are so sweet and adolescents are so complicated. My whole life had been spent trying to become an adult. I had always known in my heart that I needed to be an adult, and my instinct for self-preservation had been telling me that I could not afford to relate to a Father God who demanded that I live as a helpless child. Now I could see what I had misunderstood all along. If it is true that whoever has seen Jesus has seen the Father, it is important that in John 11, Jesus gives no sign that he expects Mary and Martha to relate to him as passive, obedient little children. Martha and Mary are Jesus' adult friends. Because they love him, they are not submissive or subservient. They are not in the least afraid of him. They are not sullen, silently angry with him. They do not accept what has happened as the will of God. They tell him they are angry and why. As for Jesus, Jesus does not simply tolerate these uppity people. He values them. He chooses them for his friends. He trusts them in their anger with him, and he trusts them with his life. This moves me to my third and perhaps most life-transforming insight from praying scripture, which is that God does not simply value us as friends. God actually chooses to need us. Now, when I look at what that means to think of the relationship of parent and child, what has struck me that is in one's own prayer life. Maybe we can think a bit of our life, and that is sort of like a family meeting. Where people speak and heard, and that the point of God is not that there's this person, well, you're going to do what you knew had to be done anyway, no matter what I think or feel. But rather that it is not that God always knows better than we do, but really quite seriously that what God knows in great part through us. and that that is something about the way we are brought along to be eternally children, but not helpless, right? Not without a place for our autonomy and our interaction. And that that says something about how we as parents can look for this development in our friends, but our own growth in our faith. And that to me was extremely helpful because prayer was an activity that has not made a lot of sense to me until I thought that perhaps I had something worth being heard, right? That I might know something that could be of value, even if somebody else has to make the decision ultimately, right? That is something about how we might look at what our children bring and where we hope to carry them as those who can be the adult friends, hopefully of us, but certainly of our God. So I will stop there and thank you all for what for me has been a great week. I've really enjoyed it immensely. And I wish you all blessings in the tasks that lie before you and hope that you go with the sense that you are not alone in this and you do something of surpassing good. Thank you.